Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
You know, I kind of wish we had, like, licensing rights, like BMI ASCAP, you know, like the rights to play pop music, which is really expensive, and I don't feel like getting taken down by various online services. Uh-huh. But I would love to open by playing the song I was just playing before. Talk Talk, It's My Life, which, you know, being 50-something years old from my high school years, I think they're British. I'm not even sure. But, man, I was so rocking to that. Such an awesome song.
I could not have told you, like, the name of the song or...
Oh, I wouldn't have been able to, like, 5 minutes ago. But I saw... Oh,
okay.
I was noodling around on Instagram waiting for you, and someone had posted the music video for it. I'm like, oh my gosh, that song! Yes! It's got to be in some 80s movie. I'm almost certain of it. Or maybe in Stranger Things or something, but 1984.
It sounded very familiar to me.
Yeah, it's like classic British invasion sort of, you know, pop music thing. We were listening to that podcast, How Music Does That, a little while ago, and he had an episode where he talked about the music from when you were 12 and when you were 14, how that music, when you hear it, it doesn't even have to be great music, but it somehow it like resonates in you.
I have to say, I loved the episode. I really appreciated it. I wanted more data. Like,
yeah.
Because he was sort of talking about, like, one, boys. So does it hold true for girls too?
Yeah.
Like the same ages? Two, people who seem to have been like immersed in popular culture and pop music during those formative years. Like me when I was 12, not so much listening to a lot of pop music.
You didn't listen to the radio or...
My parents didn't really do a lot of like if they listened to radio, it was NPR. And so like I picked up on pop songs when I was like...
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Right. When I was like hanging out at friends' houses or maybe like whatever was on the radio, like at a restaurant or a store or something. But...
See, you... Yeah, I had like...
I have these weird like gaps or lags in my knowledge of pop culture. Like I might have experienced or encountered something at different time frames.
You're the oldest child. I was the fourth. So my older brothers and sisters, they exposed me to a lot of music. Like Francesca's taste in music heavily influenced my taste in music, more so than John or Bernie. And then there was my friends, and like my friend Rick, who was like heavy metal dude. Like we were so into like Black Sabbath and stuff for a while. And I'm not so much in that, but like AC/DC, Ted Nugent stuff, that still stuck with me. So like some of the rock music. But yeah, the pop music stuff, a lot of that came from my sister. And then I listened to the radio because of that. So I could see that where you're the oldest.
Right, I'm the oldest. My parents were not really big pop music people.
And you didn't have a lot of friends that you hung with and listened to music with.
Not so much listened to music with, really. Not until like high school where I had like friends who were very into alternative.
But that's
stuff.
What we're talking about. 14
is like freshman year of high school.
That's true.
So like
it's not so much middle school as high school.
But and then again, like are those the formative peers for boys and girls, or do boys, like girls we know mature earlier, boys mature later? Like is there a difference?
Here's the experiment to try for you, dear listener. If you have Apple Music, Spotify probably has us too.
Probably.
Go find the playlist for the year when you were 12 and the year when you were 14 and listen to those and see how much they resonate with you. Like the best of 82 or something, you know, like what those years. I mean, 84 is actually later for me. That's not 12 or 14. That's more like 16, I guess. So, but still, it's I don't know. It's interesting. Anyway.
A lot of pop music that resonates with me is like my college years. But in the How Music Does That podcast, he really talked about it's not so much the like this is good music. It's more like this is music which hits me at an emotional
right.
spot.
Right.
Like a nostalgia.
I'll hear a song and be and I'm transported back to a feeling, a place. Like I'll hear a song and I'll think of I'll remember reading a book, a particular book while listening to that song. Like the or being in at home in my bedroom at that age and, you know, or whatever. It's just he's right. It does transport me. It's really kind of fascinating. And I wonder if the same will hold true for kids today, because kids today who are 12 and 14 don't listen to music in the same way we did. Well, they don't listen to pop music radio stations. They have a hugely, massively eclectic amount of music.
I mean, my guess would be that objectively, the songs that you heard during that time period will have the same effect on you. It's just that it won't be so easily categorized right. by the time
by genre,
came, by genre yeah. and the time it came out, etc. Like,
will it be like Instagram or TikTok viral tracks that lots of video, you know, TikTok videos?
It would be hard. Make? In other words, it might be harder to track down what you were listening to at right. a particular time in your life based on some sort of like demographic data.
I'm curious. In our own kids, they're all their music is Star Wars, although Bella's starting to expand into more classical music.
I love it when Bella comes and she's like, I just discovered, you know,
Bach or Beethoven or something.
Bach or Beethoven or
Debussy,
Rimsky-Korsakov.
It's funny. That sounds wicked pretentious. Our children love to listen to classical music. What do your children listen to? But it's not really that. It's just, I mean, because we play all kinds of music for them. Playlists of pop music
I just
of all
put,
kinds.
On Saturday, when the kids and I were driving in the car, I put on Shuffle, and we went through traditional Irish, Dean Martin, The Pogues, something like Jimmy Buffett. Something U2.
They get everything.
Something that was like swing.
Yep.
And then some classical and some Gregorian chant. And I like it was really sort of just a cross section of like
music,
everything.
All music. Yes.
And so I think that kids these days can often be exposed to music in that sort of jumbled playlist auto shuffle way where it doesn't really fit into particular genres. It's just music.
They probably get more music, more variety of music than we ever did. That's for sure.
Oh, definitely.
So that was just a little digression to begin, just because I was playing that song ahead of time and it made me think about it. But as we start, I wanted to mention some listener feedback we got. Michael C sent a message on YouTube on the SQPN YouTube channel, where all of our podcasts get posted as audio videos. He says, excellent podcast. I agree with you about Marvel's world building. My wife and I greatly dislike that Marvel wrote themselves into a corner and then quote unquote fixed it with time travel. World building should make sense and impose the limits of the universe, not to just get destroyed every time they can't fix something. They have a lot of good story writing, but sometimes they miss out on the big picture stuff. Now,
I definitely feel like there is a lot of world building is so important to me. Like yeah. that to me is what makes or breaks a work
yes.
of literature, of fiction, you know, whether it's books or movies or TV shows. I don't necessarily know for sure if Marvel has written themselves into a corner or not.
I'm pretty certain that when spoilers for Avengers Endgame, if you haven't watched this gigantic movie, $1 billion movie from 3 or 4 years ago, but when Loki meets his demise in Avengers Endgame at the very beginning, I'm pretty sure they knew exactly what they were doing.
They didn't kill off a favorite character, believing it was permanent, and then oh no, we have to scramble to revive him.
No, I think that the Loki series was entirely planned
from the beginning,
from long before that, because with the MCU they've given us these maps, the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 map. Like, they've mapped out the entire strategy that they're going for with these. So I'm pretty sure that they're not just reacting and not knowing where they're going with this.
Now,
That said,
I feel like I am tentatively giving them space. Like, this is obviously a story arc in the making rather than a story arc that's completed.
You have to land this ship.
Right. I so far am going, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt that this is going to come down somewhere. But so far, I am still very on the fence about the time travel plot. So I'm willing to give it some time. I'm willing to see where it goes from here. But yeah, time travel.
I think this is generally the comic book problem, which is comic books are constantly rebooting and reinventing themselves, almost like soap operas in a sense.
Although I have to say, from the point of view of world building, knowing that comic books are constantly reinventing themselves and rebooting, I kind of like the multiverse as a concept which allows for that kind of rebooting, because then you have at least a worldview, a schematic by which it makes sense to have new variations, because a multiverse allows you to say this is just happening in a different world.
Well, in fact,
a different timeline.
DC has done that because we've had the TV Flash. And then we had the movie Flash, which was a different guy, and fans were upset. Like, are you undoing the TV Flash? Because we love Grant Gustin as the TV Flash. And in fact, they had a crossover event where the movie Flash ended up on TV Flash's show. Because they also do multiverse thing, because DC and Marvel are constantly copying each other. But
I mean, I think it makes sense from a storytelling perspective that when you've got multiple authors dealing with the same characters and you have different sorts of stories that don't necessarily jive well, you've got to have some way of reconciling them.
Right. And also it gives the option to explore and do new things. I mean, I am not opposed to the idea of either time travel or multiverse things. I mean, heck, one of my favorite shows is Doctor Who, where there's lots of time travel. But
the storytelling can be done well or can be done poorly.
Right. And we've seen both on Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
But and multiverse stuff, you know, is OK. I mean, I don't have a fundamental problem with it. But you're right. The writing has to be good. They can't just lean on, oh, multiverse will fix it. Oh, you know, wave a hand at time travel and don't look too closely and it's okay.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yes. Don't be all wibbly wobbly. One of my common complaints with some of the Moffat era writing, or especially the Chris Chibnall writing, is there's sometimes a little too much hand wavy going on.
Yes.
Don't look over under this curtain here, you know, behind this curtain sort of stuff. But thank you, Michael, for your feedback. We really do appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
We love getting feedback. Gives us more to talk about. And to think about. All right, let's talk about what we've done this past week.
It's been a busy week.
Let me start, and then you can go. It's been a busy weekend. So on Friday, I, along with the three oldest, Isabella, Sophia, and Benedict, we loaded up, got in the van, and headed north to Newfound Lake, New Hampshire, which is in it's a big lake. So I'm not sure exactly which town it was in, but at various times I saw on the computer said Bristol, Bridgewater, and a couple other places in New
Hampshire. All of the above.
So, but it's in Wellington State Park, Newfound Lake, New Hampshire. So our both scout troops, Ben's troop and the girls' troop, together went on this trip. It was mostly because the girls have brothers in the other troop, so it's like a big family thing. Anyway,
right. It's just sort of logistically,
it's easier for all of us to go on these trips.
They have separate trips that are just girls and just boys trips, right, things, but sometimes there's a nice fun crossover.
When we do the big thing, it's usually, you know, we have nearby sites and that sort of stuff. So at this lake, there's not a regular camping there, but they have group camping, and they have an island, Cliff Island, and there's two big sites, like hold like 40, 50. I think I saw something that said the island was 9 acres. And it is very rocky. Lots of, you know, it's New Hampshire, the Granite State. So it's lots of huge granite boulders, tall spruce and pines, very little undergrowth. So it was really ideal for camping on. Primitive conditions, no bathrooms, but there were outhouses, but no running water. So we had to bring all our water with us, that sort of thing. And we had canoes. We had rented a bunch of canoes, and there was like 40 of us, and we had a dozen canoes. I think it was something along those lines. I forget exactly what the numbers were, and a rowboat. and we rode from the shore to the island, which the rowing from the launch was like I'd say half mile, but the distance from the closest point of shore to the island was like 100 feet. It wasn't that far, maybe 200 feet. But it was like not accessible shore from, you know, the trails was in the woods.
So the island was close to the shore, but the point from which you could launch a boat
was about a half mile away. You had to follow the shoreline down to it.
Okay. So a half mile of rowing.
Yes.
That's not too bad.
It wasn't too bad. Or canoeing or paddling.
Right.
Bella and Sophia and Ben, none of them are, the first time any of them went paddling in a canoe was a few weeks ago.
Although Ben's done kayak.
But he's done kayaking. And
so is Bella.
Yeah. It took Bella a while. Ben was with me. Sophie and Bella were with two other girls who had a little more experience. And it took Bella. Bella was the steerer in the back. And so it took her a while to get the hang of it. She was like all zigzagging all over the lake. And that we had to stay slow. Our canoes were loaded down with gear. My biggest fear was we'd flip and gear would go to the bottom. That was my biggest fear.
It didn't happen.
There were other fears I should have had. So as we're getting out there, we're looking out over the lake, and the Lake Winnipesaukee is over the hills further on, and we saw like thunderstorms going down there and the clouds were building. I was getting a little worried. And so we were the first group on with canoes loaded on the lake. We went as groups, like of a couple canoes at a time. And we started going and going, and I could feel the wind kind of picking up a little bit and getting a little colder, which is a sure sign that rain is coming. And just as we got to the landing place on the island, and we unloaded our canoes, pulled them up, it started raining. And then it rained harder. And like we're trying to move the gear up undercover, and more boats are coming in, and it's deluge. I mean, it was raining so hard at one point, like it was almost like you were underwater. And I can't imagine what it was like for the ones who were still in the canoes on the lake. And there was lightning and there was,
oh boy.
Some of them said they felt hail. Like they felt like they're good. Sometimes rain can feel like being pelted by solid stuff, but some of them thought it was hail. Like there was no way they should have been on the water, but there was no way to know. Like we didn't know this storm was coming. It just kind of flew in from around on the other side of this island. We couldn't see it coming. And, we were soaked to the bone, cold. Poor Sophie was miserable. We found an Adirondack shelter, which is it's kind of like a lean-to or half open cabin. Like it's got three walls with a overhang, so it's got some shelter. And we just had to, move stuff as quick as we can. All this gear, everything was soaked. We were soaked to the bone, like I'd fallen in the water. And eventually we got a fire going. We got tents set up. The rain stopped. It was just a passing summer thunderstorm. Got tents set up, got the kids changed, got them some dinner. And then it started raining again around 9 o'clock. So we just called it a night. I was going to sleep in a hammock because I hate sleeping on the ground. I can never get a good night's sleep on the ground. But because of the rain, I ended up sleeping in the tent with Ben. And boy, it was a long night. I tell you, I did not sleep well. I cannot sleep on the ground. It's just, ugh. And, but Saturday was beautiful. I was up at dawn because I didn't sleep. And Sophie and I walked down to the other end of the island and some beautiful, like, mist and fog rolling across the lake. We went to the beach. There's a beach at the state park. We canoed over to this beach for the morning, between breakfast and lunch, and hung out there, and the kids had a blast. But we'd seen the forecast that the rain was coming in. At first, before we left, the forecast was it would start raining around 8, which is late enough that we would be up. When you're camping, you get up early with the sun. We'd get up, get some quick breakfast to go, and then pack up and go. But the forecast moved it early to like 5 a.m., and it's like, oh, none of us wanted to try to load up and canoe back in the rain. Just even if it's just regular rain, that would be, because then you'd be miserable driving home.
Like, driving home soaking wet for the rest of the day.
And I frankly, I don't think I actually had another set of dry clothes after that, or at least a full set. I had like a couple of, like, I think I had long pants I could have put on. But so we decided, the girls' troop and that includes me and the two girls, and I decided for Ben, we were just going to, after dinner, go back to shore and go home, pack up and go. The boys' troop, they decided there was a camping spot, a group spot on the shore that wasn't being used, and they were just going to go over there and stay the night there and leave in the morning.
So that they wouldn't have to...
They wouldn't have to
canoe
back in the rain. They still have to pack up in the rain. And frankly, by the time we got everything over there and canoes loaded up, because they didn't have to, that way they wouldn't have to load them up the next day, canoes loaded up in trailers and all that sort of stuff, it was 9 o'clock. It was like nearly, it was 8:30 when I drove off, and they still hadn't gotten over to the site yet where they were going to stay. So I don't know. Like I'm looking forward to talking to them tomorrow night,
seeing what happened.
Yeah, because I didn't see the point. Like set up your tent in the dark, and so you can sleep here another night and get up in the rain at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Maybe they didn't want to drive at night.
It's probably
some people really, really don't like driving at night.
Well, it was I mean that's the other thing is I wanted to leave earlier because I really didn't want to leave that late. We didn't get home till 11, and I hadn't had a good night's sleep, so I was super tired. Getting back to our house by the last 20 minutes were really tough staying awake. So, but we got back, and then I think the kids were all just as well. They loved it. Despite the first night, the rain that first day, they loved it. They want to go back. They had a blast. All the adults were saying this is something we should make into a regular thing we do every year, because there is a lot to recommend it. I mean, if it hadn't poured on us, it would have been a perfect weekend. So, and Bristol, New Hampshire, the little town, is beautiful, pretty little town. I would love to go up there and check it out again because it was just a beautiful little place. So that was our weekend. Now you stayed home with Lucy and Anthony.
Right. So I did not want them to feel left out. So I decided to plan fun weekend with mom for the two littles. So on Friday after you left, We went and ran some errands. We ran to the post office and the library, and they got some books out, which is always a treat. And then I had promised Anthony a while back that I would get him some jerk chicken because he really loves it.
We've talked about the little Jamaican place down the street from us.
And then I kept forgetting. So I decided to keep my promise to him, and we went and got some jerk chicken for lunch on Friday. Now, Lucy wasn't so sure because she remembers the last time we got it, it was really spicy. But the last time we got it, she couldn't eat the fried chicken.
Right.
Because she
still had the wheat allergy.
Right. As far as we knew, she still couldn't eat wheat. So this time I said, I'll get you some fried chicken. They have really, really good non-spicy fried chicken.
It was really good.
And she was like, oh, I don't know. And I said, well, I'll get you the fried chicken. If you don't like it, we'll find something else for you to eat. And so she was game. She said, okay. And we got home and she loved it. And Anthony and I split an order of the order is huge of jerk chicken. And they give you piles of rice, which is pretty spicy. And then a salad, including like pickled cucumbers and cabbage and like lots of lettuce and tomatoes and cucumbers. I also got a chicken curry patty. They're like,
oh, their patties are really good.
They're like pasties, pastry shell with meat filling.
It's like a pasty, a calzone. That it's in that family of filled meat filled pockets.
But the Jamaican ones are just
hot pockets.
Oh my gosh, they're so good.
It was so good.
And then we watched Luca on Friday afternoon.
The new Pixar animated,
which was really good. I really liked it a lot. Oh, it's so beautiful. It's Italy.
The Cinque Terre.
And it's just gorgeous. And it's a really sweet movie. I love the story.
Yeah.
And then Anthony and Lucy ended up, Lucy ended up sleeping in with me. I guess the last time she ended up camping out with Anthony, and they ended up kicking each other all night. So she said none of that. So instead she kicked me all night.
She's a mover when she sleeps. Every morning she's on the floor next to her bed.
Yeah. So
that's why she'll never sleep on a top bunk.
And then on Saturday we got up and, we got a late start, but we went to the farmer's market because they really wanted to. And by the time we got to the farmer's market, there were no pastries left.
At the baker's.
Yeah. So we decided to go over to the beach and get ice cream at the snack shack at the beach.
Ice cream cones.
We got ice cream cones, which is, yeah, a huge treat. We never get ice cream cones. We usually just buy the, you know, half gallon or whatever it is, not 2 pint.
1.5 pints.
of ice cream and, you know, share it out at home. So we don't go out for ice cream very often. And that was great. I was the one who dropped my ice cream cone in the sand.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that.
fortunately, it was after I'd already eaten the big ball on the top, and it was just at the level of the cone. And it had a paper holder on it.
Uh-huh. How long did you think I make people to save that?
No, I did save it. I scraped off the part with the sand, which was only one corner, and pulled off all the sandy bits, and then I ate the rest of the cone. Totally did. I saved my ice cream.
Was there any sand in it?
I had one grain of sand in my mouth that I detected. One piece of grit.
To quote Anakin, I hate sand. It gets everywhere.
And we walked on the beach a little bit, but it was super crowded. It was a beautiful day. And I asked the kids if they wanted to walk down the beach a ways. And they kind of looked at the crowd and they're like,
no.
I'd be okay to go back to the car. Yeah, that would be okay with me. They were really sticky from their ice cream, too. Anyway, we got back to the car. I told them that they were not allowed to get into the car until I'd cleaned them up because they were super sticky. And I put Lucy's Grogu on the roof of the car.
Let's pause here. Lucy got a plastic Grogu doll for her birthday this year. And not just Lucy, all of them love this doll. I think we've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And this doll goes with her everywhere. She sleeps with him.
It's hard plastic, but she still sleeps with it. Like, she cuddles it.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
As if it were plush.
And this doll has a life of his own. Like, they have him as if he is another member of the family part of their games.
He's got stories and personality and all sorts of things. They feed him food and, like, tuck him into bed and carry him around like a baby.
They all love him. Okay. Proceed.
So I stuck Grogu, who was covered in chocolate ice cream, on top of the roof of the car while I got out my hanky and poured water on it and tried to clean up Lucy, who was she had ice cream from her forehead to her knees. She was really into her chocolate ice cream, and it was a warm day and they gave her an awful lot that was kind of overflowing the cone. And we got about halfway home and Lucy said, "Where's Grogu?" And I remembered putting Grogu on top of the car, and I did not remember taking Grogu off the top of the car when we got in to drive away. We turned around and we drove back to the beach, and nary a Grogu was to be found.
He was covered in chocolate. A seagull probably took off with him.
There wasn't that much chocolate, but he had some.
When you texted me when I was on the island, my heart dropped, because not only did I sympathize and empathize with poor Lucy, who was probably crying her eyes out, I had to tell the others. Kids, come over, sit down. I have some hard news for you. No, your mother's okay. Your brother and sister are okay. I hate to tell you, the Grogu is missing. What? They were just as devastated.
She was
they were devastated for Lucy, really. They knew how much that would be bad.
The thing is, she's 8 now, and she doesn't do the toddler temper tantrum crying anymore. She does the stoic 8-year-old heartbroken crying, which is just like
worse.
It's like tears just pouring down her face and the little crumpled up face, but it's silent. And I knew she cried all the way home. And Anthony, like all the way to the point where we turned around, he continued to stare out the window, scanning the side of the street, hoping against hope that maybe Grogu had made it that far and then fallen off the car and he could spot Grogu. And we got to the point where we had turned around and he's like, "Oh, he's gone forever."
Oh, stab right to my heart.
Yeah, it was it was horrible.
This is one of the worst things. Like, I mean, barring real tragedy, this is one of the worst things for parents. When the beloved toy is missing and there's nothing you can do about getting it back.
Yeah, I mean, it was gone.
So what'd we do?
I bought a new one.
Amazon Prime to the rescue.
Yeah, I overnighted a new toy. Now, they didn't have the model that she had yet anymore. I got her a bigger, better one.
Well, this is actually the better one. This is the one we should have gotten in the first place. It's slightly bigger. It has a plastic head, but the body is plush.
Yeah, it's really soft and squishy and cuddly.
And she's happy. We talked about, I kind of said that Grogu went off to have a growth spurt and came back. And I mean, she knows what that it's a different one. But you also talked to her, too.
Right. I told her, well, maybe there is another child who really, really needed comfort and a friend right now. And maybe they found Grogu and picked him up and took him home because they really needed somebody. And so she really liked that story. And she said, somebody needed him more than I did. Which is actually, I can't take full credit for that because that's totally the Nuffle Bunny story.
It's the Nuffle Bunny story. The question is what if next week we go down to the farmer's market and someone goes, oh, by the way, we recognize this must be yours.
Then she'll have to.
Wait, didn't we do that once before where we left a beloved stuffed animal at the market? Wasn't it one of the penguins?
I don't remember.
I think that happened once before. To, like, Bella or Sophie.
I do know that Lucy lost a beloved doll at the farmer's market once. It was a St. Lucia doll that a friend had made for her and sent us. And that was totally gone.
That's never been come back.
It's never come back.
Was that the pin doll? The wooden one?
No, it was a soft stuff, like, okay. Like a pillow doll.
I'm sure this is, every parent goes through this, where children drop a toy, a beloved toy that...
Oh, which is why Mo Willems got three books. Three Nuffle Bunny books yes. out of the phenomenon.
Yes, he does.
So...
capitalizing on our pain.
I highly recommend, by the way, the Nuffle Bunny series.
Yes, they are really good.
It's Nuffle with a K. K-N-U-F-F-L-E, by the way. Yeah. Oh, so
it,
good.
I mean, the kids love it. Parents love it because there's that classic... the stuff the parents get and the stuff that kids get in the same package. It's really good. Yeah, definitely.
So what did we do on Saturday? We came home. She read for a while. She lost herself in Mysterious Benedict Society. And then they ended up watching Mulan.
The animated Mulan. Yeah.
Because the girls had seen it when the boys were off on a camping trip at one point. And so Anthony was missing out on the Mulan experience and wanted to find out what he had missed.
That was a while ago. That was when we went up to the Clark's Trading Post, I think.
Anthony's memory is retentive.
Especially when he's missed out on something.
Yes. So they enjoyed Mulan and I had some quiet time.
And they got along really well.
When it's just the two of them, they get along so wonderfully. You would never believe it because when everybody's present, Anthony and Lucy bicker like nonstop, cats and dogs. I don't understand it. You would think that they would get along worse when it's just the two of them, but no. Without any external
prompting
or anything, and they just
pushing them from outside.
I don't know. It's like magic. But it's good. I mean, it's good that they have these experiences because they know that they like each other.
This is true. Well, and that's the thing is, I mean, as adults, I mean, my sister Evelyn and I fought like cats and dogs as kids. But as adults, we get along really well. I mean, whenever it is that causes that sort of conflict, it goes away. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure what their particular dynamic is, but for Evie and I, we got along better when we weren't under the same roof. But that's our busy, busy week. Yeah. So let's move on. Talk about cooking. Well, since I was away, you were doing catch-as-catch-can with food. We didn't have a lot of different things we made this week, but I did make hot and sour soup, which is one of my favorite soups to get. It's probably my favorite Chinese takeout soup over wonton or egg drop. I judge the quality of a Chinese restaurant by its hot and sour soup. And that's because soup is not the most popular thing on any Chinese restaurant menu. It's sort of a second thing. And if they do it really well, it tells me they're paying attention. They want, you know, to the quality and they want to do really well. That's my unscientific judgment. So I really like hot and sour soup and I've had some really good ones and I've always wanted to make it at home and I've made it a few times. And so I last week at the farmer's market, the mushroom guy had woodier mushrooms, which is one of the ingredients. You know, I usually only get the dried ones, but he had fresh wood ears. So I said, which is it's sort of a spongy fungus style, like almost like seaweedy a texture almost. Anyway.
Yeah, they're not like the texture.
They're not
is
like
very
stem
different.
And cap mushrooms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had those in shiitakes. And so I made the soup and it was okay. I have some ideas of how I can improve it. It wasn't spicy enough for me. Like the white pepper is the key spice flavoring, and I didn't feel like I really got that white pepper hot part of it. The sour was there, but the hot part
was there.
See,
I thought it was exactly the opposite. Like, I thought it needed more sour.
Hmm. It maybe could have used some more sour, too.
I thought the vinegar needed to be amped up a bit.
It probably did. Yeah, you're right. I think on both ends. There was a lot about it that I liked, but I mean, I ate most of it myself, but there's some improvement that can be made. Now, the pork part, there's always pork in hot and sour soup. I used some country style pork ribs that I'd picked up and had in the freezer. I got it for something else, but there was way more pork than I needed. So we said, well, what do we do all the rest of this pork? And so you said, let's make some pork fried rice.
Right. We had a whole ton of rice left over in the fridge. So it was crying out for fried rice. And, well, who doesn't like pork fried rice, right?
Right.
So you just put some, like, salt.
I put some salt and soy sauce
on the pork.
And let it sort of sit for a little bit.
Right. And then I just fried it up. Like, I put some oil in a pan and fried up the pork. It was amazing. Sure. It was so good.
I'm not sure what the difference is. I mean, I'm going to put you in charge of fried rice from now on because that was really good.
It was just like really simple. I didn't even add egg or anything to the rice. It was just like rice with some sesame seeds, sesame oil and soy sauce. And I threw in some like
frozen veggies,
frozen peas and corn. And I threw in some fresh scallions.
Right.
But it was the pork. The pork was just like so good.
Yeah. I think it's the cut. I think that country spare rib or the country rib. Country style rib? I forget exactly.
It was really tender, but it was really flavorful. Like, it had a lot of that porky flavor.
Yeah, yeah. It really wants to have that quick cook like that. And I'd cut it fairly small, like matchstick size, which meant it cooked real fast so that you didn't have to overcook it in order to get it cooked.
Right.
I think
that's part of it.
Yeah.
The quick hot cook.
So... the recipe I use for the hot and sour, I kind of combined from a bunch of different ones. There's a Ming Tsai recipe on the Food Network website. There was a Cook's Illustrated version, which was the main one I went with. And there was another one that I was kind of cribbing some ingredients from, like daylilies and some of the, like, that's a more, even more exotic recipe. I got the daylily pods, the dried daylilies from an Asian market. I don't even remember where, but that's the thing about hot and sour soup is it requires a bunch of specialty ingredients like Chinese black vinegar and some stuff like that. So it was never all that easy to get a good version of it. But I have the ingredients and I made it and it was really good. I'm going
to
do it again.
I used to make like totally cheater hot and sour soup when I was a teen. It had none of the special ingredients.
Right.
It was just like, but it was good.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can make something that's totally edible without all the fancy stuff.
Yeah, but I want the...
But you like the super fancy.
In fact, it's the sort of thing where if I didn't have to worry about feeding everyone, I would make many times to try to perfect it.
Right.
I would like once a week or several times a week until... I did this when I was single. I would, like with curry. I ate curry 3 times a week when I was single because I kept trying to make it better and better and better. Anyway, so, yeah, so that's what we've been eating. Let's talk about our reading and watching. So I watched a movie called Monsters. It's a 2010 movie directed by Gareth Edwards, who would later go on to direct the Star Wars movie, Rogue One. My gosh, it went right out of my head. Rogue One. And famously, Rogue One had to be like the ending had to be reshot and they had another director come in to cut it. And it was like, oh, a disaster. It turns out Rogue One is the best of the sequel of the Disney era movies, Star Wars movies. But this was still when he was young and or not even that long ago, but when he was before he was big name, he made this movie ultra low budget. I think his budget was $50,000. It's a monster movie, as the title will say. The premise is that at some point, a rocket carrying samples of alien life discovered in a comet or something like that, crashed over Mexico, northern Mexico. And over the course of 6 years, that life has spread and become these huge, they look kind of like octopuses on land, like giant octopuses that kind of glow. And they're super destructive, super violent and aggressive. And there's this now this infection zone that encompasses most of northern Mexico and southern in the border, basically like 100 kilometers on either side of the border between the U.S. and Mexico is this exclusion zone. There's this guy, he's a newspaper or magazine photographer in Mexico City, and the magazine publisher's daughter is there, and he needs to get her out. This is, I don't know, a seasonal migration or something like that, where the boats can't go, and I don't know why she couldn't fly, but for some reason flying was not possible. There's a little bit of a, they didn't address it, but she had to get to this ferry. She didn't make the ferry, so they had to cross the zone. So you don't see a lot. It's super low budget. All of the visual effects were made by him on his Mac in his apartment, you know, and for that, he did a pretty good job. I mean, it does have a, you know, big movie feeling to it. It was all shot like it was the two actors and then like three or four crew in a van just driving around Mexico. They would hire locals to be extras or actors in various scenes.
Sounds like the kind of thing some of my college friends would have like done if they had a little bit more of a budget.
Well, right, plus they have access these days to like all of this movie quality, you know, consumer electronics.
Yeah, my friends were just like a decade too early, like, yeah, because they were still trying to do like Super 8,
right? And so the interesting thing is the two actors, the main characters, were themselves in a relationship. So it was like he wanted to get to, and they're not really, they're unknowns. I mean, they've done other things, but I had never seen them in anything else. So it was an interesting movie. Very much, you know exactly where it's going. You know, it's fairly predictable in the shape of things, of the overall plot. And how it's going to develop. They don't break any new ground there. But it still was interesting to watch this low-budget movie. And there were still some good parts of it. It could have been more monster, which obviously they couldn't do because they didn't have the budget at the time. But it's fascinating to see art made with constraints. And that's what this was. He was making something with constraints. He didn't have a blank check budget like a J.J. Abrams can get, or a Steven right. Spielberg, or, you know, these big names. He had to work with the constraints he was given. So the last I heard about, so this was 2010. I saw something online that said that British TV had picked up the rights to remake it as a series, as a limited run series.
Oh, interesting.
Which would be, and then maybe could show up on Netflix or something like that, which I haven't heard anything since, but that would be interesting to see them remake it with a bigger budget and whether that would make a difference.
Hmm.
So that was Monsters.
I wonder if they would continue to have it set in Mexico, or they would move the setting to, was Mexico like the setting?
The setting was integral to this story. The way, I think the third world setting, trying to get into the first world, I think that was somewhat integral to the feel. I mean, it had the feel of like there. I've seen other movies where it was the daughter of a wealthy, important person is stuck in a war zone, a place that's becoming a war zone.
Right.
And the employee of that person has been tasked with getting her to safety.
Right. That's sort of
that's what it is, except instead of, you know, enemy soldiers or, you know, guerrillas, not the GUER guerrillas.
Guerrillas. Yes.
It's monsters, you know, so it's a different kind of obstacle. But, I mean, you've seen this story a million times, but I think it's integral to going from it was a primitive situation to try to get home. And without revealing too much, I think that was somewhat integral to the story.
Interesting.
Yeah. So what have you been watching and reading?
All right. So watching, I watched Luca with the kids. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that. I've also been working on catching up with Clone Wars, which I have a lot to catch up on, but I've now finished watching most of the episodes in season two. I've skipped a few that.
According to the essentials list that I gave you.
Yes. I'm actually looking at two different essentials lists because I found another one that was sort of essentials to watch before watching The Bad Batch.
Ah.
And so I'm kind of going back and forth. If an episode is on one or other of the two lists, then I'm watching it. And if it's on neither of them, then I'm skipping it for now.
Okay.
Or if something looks interesting to me, because like, okay.
You're not necessarily going to have the same taste in things as the typical Star Wars fan.
Right. So like the Boba Fett arc, I'm like, okay, I want to see Boba Fett. I don't remember if it was on the list or not, but I watched the.
Well, given that the Book of Boba Fett is coming, this is now on the must watch list.
I feel like watching anything with Boba Fett is sort of a must watch at this point anyway. Yeah. So I watched that. So now I'm done with season two for now. I might go back and pick up the episodes later. And then today the kids and I watched the first episode of Bad Batch.
Yes, I stuck around for that too.
Which, okay, yes, I haven't watched most of Clone Wars, so there was a lot of things that the kids were like, oh yeah, because I haven't seen any of the Bad Batch episodes yet.
The Bad Batch episodes of Clone Wars, yeah.
Of Clone Wars. So the kids knew all the characters, but I still thought it was enjoyable. It was fun. I sort of went into it knowing I will probably be spoiled on a few things, and I don't know a lot of the characters well, but I don't care. I just don't want to be behind on two series that they've been watching. So right. I just made the decision that I'm just going to skip ahead.
Skip ahead, brother, may not.
I was waiting for that. So, yeah.
So, Bad Batch. Yes.
Bad Batch.
Yeah. Rewatching that first episode was longer. It's an hour long, that first episode. They did a double length episode. Yeah. And it's just really good. Watching the development, how they spin it out, and some of the subtle things they do that I notice on the second time through. And of course, there's the big cameo at the very beginning.
Oh my gosh! Yes.
Yeah,
it's a favorite character.
It is a brilliant way to start a new series with a beloved character showing up.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
So then I've been reading. I always want to call it the Crystal Palace, but it's the Glass Palace by Amitav Ghosh. I enjoyed the Ibis series so much, I decided to read another Amitav Ghosh book.
Okay.
This one is set primarily in Burma. The Glass Palace of the title is the palace in which the last king of Burma lives. And as the novel opens, you've got a boy who is Indian, but who is an orphan who is sort of washed up on the shores. Like literally, he was in a boat with his parents and they both died, and he's washed up on the shores of Burma, and he's trying to, you know, make his own way in the world. Right at the same time, almost, the British come marching in and take over Burma.
Okay.
And the last king of Burma is taken into custody by the British and shipped off with his family to India because they don't want him to be the locus of a Burmese rising, but they don't really want to summarily execute him either. So it's sort of a
compromise
situation. So the story then follows the boy, whose name I'm suddenly blanking on, and he sort of becomes a self-made man. He ends up investing money. He finds a patron who is half. I think one of his parents is European and the other is Malayan.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's sort of a missionary in Burma, and he takes this boy under his wing a little bit. And then you also follow the royal family, the Burmese royal family in exile in India. And they have four daughters, and they've brought these serving girls who are orphans who were taking care of the queen and her daughters.
Uh-huh.
And so there's one girl, Dolly, who the boy had run into as the palace was being looted. He got caught up in the crowd that was looting the palace, and he ran into this serving girl with the queen, and she sort of stuck in his head, and he gets fixated on her, and he goes in search of her years later after he becomes wealthy.
Huh.
And so you kind of shift these points of view, and then you've got another character who Dolly meets in India, who's the wife of this Indian official who was educated in Cambridge and then sort of entered the civil service and went back to India in the British civil service. So you've got a big cast of characters. It's really interesting because I know very little about Burma. And so seeing some of that colonial history is kind of fascinating. There's a lot about teak.
The wood.
And so, the one main character makes his fortune basically in the teak industry.
Teak wood is extremely important in shipbuilding.
Right.
Yeah.
They later invest in rubber plantations, and they have one of the first rubber plantations in Malaya, right on the cusp of World War One, when rubber became incredibly important.
So that's when the rubber met the road.
Right. So where I am in the novel now, they've just heard the news of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. They don't yet know that war is beginning, but right. War is beginning.
Interesting.
But it's really interesting. It's a big sweep of a novel. I think it's supposed to cover like 100 years, according to the blurb on the back. And, you know, shifting back and forth between Malaya, Burma, and...
Malaysia. Burma.
And India.
Yeah.
Right. And one character ends up going off to London, but you really only hear about that in her letters back. And then she goes to the U.S. So there's a very international feel to it. And I really like that. Like, it's a part of the world I don't know much about, and I'm really enjoying the immersion in the culture, the food, the language, and the sort of hybrid cultures, the mixing, the
right.
And the economics, there's a lot about economics and sort of the socio-political economic point of view. You know, there's the stuff about like the teak harvesting kind of reminded me of like, you know how Laura Ingalls Wilder in the Little House on the Prairie series goes into excruciating detail at points about like the processes of building a railroad grade or digging a well or building a log cabin.
Right.
And I love that. I love the sort of the process narrative. And he really does that with like how to harvest teak and how these cities build up and the camps work and how the character goes from like...
Well, because that sort of stuff, people don't arise out of nowhere, like in a lot of novels. People arise out of places and situations and the way things happen because teak plantations do this. And the culture of the local area becomes a certain way. Like a coal mining town is different from a steel town, is different from an auto manufacturing town. Because of the particulars having to do with those particular industries. Right.
And there is a good deal of critique of colonialism and of the British, which is also interesting. Like, I really find the critique of Britain's colonialism in Southeast Asia from the...
Southwest Asia? India, that area is Southeast. Southwest. Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, that's more Southeast.
Right. Okay, yeah, anyway.
Sorry.
Southwest Asia. But I find it interesting from that point of view, like from somebody who is from that culture and he's writing the characters. He has European and American characters in his novels, but in the same way that like an American or European novel might have Indian or Burmese characters, but the dynamics are really different. And it's fascinating. His critiques of the British colonialism, like I've heard critiques from sort of a Western point of view, but it's really different to hear the Eastern point of view, like how they see the British coming in. And there's one point where one character says, you know, the Indian character says to the Burmese girl, aren't you scared living with the queen? She had, you know, hundreds of people killed to get her husband to the top to become king of Burma. And the Burmese girl like stops and pauses for a minute. And then she says, well, when I come into your house, I see a picture of Queen Victoria on the wall. And aren't you scared to live in a house with a picture of a queen on the wall who's killed thousands or millions of people? who's responsible for the deaths. And it was a very interesting turning of the tables and like sort of considering like the levels of violence and bloodshed that went into the creation of the British Empire.
But also the perspective from in, from the inside, it looks a lot different from the outside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, that, that sort of turning the tables and the perspective was the opposite of what would expect. And yet there's a really interesting point of view shift there for me.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah, I'm
cool. Well, it, I'm glad you picked these up because it's it seems fascinating. So let's talk about some Catholic things. This week, the gospel readings have to do with the multiplication of loaves and fishes. And from John chapter 6, every summer we get these readings. And the usual critique of homilies, it's kind of funny how there's become this sort of this meme or this way of talking about this where we kind of we assume that some priests and deacons are going to preach about that the miracle is that everyone shared. That's the real miracle, is that everyone dug into their bags and shared the food that they had.
I've never actually heard a homily that
I did once
did that.
At some very liberal parish in Maine years ago. And
I've seen the critiques, but I haven't actually seen the phenomenon that's being critiqued.
Now, I will criticize that just as much as anyone else. Like because it's demiracalizing Jesus. It's as if Jesus couldn't, you know, wouldn't bother to do a miracle or wasn't capable of doing a miracle, that he's not really God or somehow. No, the miracle of loaves and fishes is Jesus multiplying food to feed the people. Now, Pope Francis, in his Angelus message, said something along the lines of, you know, for this Sunday, that the miracle is the sharing. And I saw people, you know, leap on that as if it was the same thing. But it's not, because, you know, what the Pope was saying is that there is a miracle. Jesus does perform a miracle. He multiplies loaves and fishes. But the mechanism by which the miracle occurs is in the generosity of the boy who gives up his loaves and fishes to Jesus. Jesus doesn't make them out of thin air. He could. He could have.
So by analogy.
Yes.
It's like the matter of the Eucharist is the bread and wine. And it's because we provide the bread and wine that God is able to confect the Eucharist.
Or that, yes.
I mean, he could.
The bounds that God has created for how the sacrament works. Yes.
Right. Like, I mean, of course, God
bound himself to that.
Of course, we know that God can create wine from water, for example. Well,
God could
and
have
bread from stones, as Satan says to Jesus in the desert. So God could create the Eucharist out of nothing, out of thin air.
Right. Jesus could have at the Last Supper said, poof, let there be bread and wine in front of me. And now they are my body and blood. Like he could have done it ex nihilo. That doesn't limit God. You know, God is not limited in any way like that. He could have done it. He chose to do it in a way that meant that we had to supply in our humanness the bread and the wine, which is the work of human hands, as the Mass prayer says. We are participating in that, and that participation mirrors the participation of this boy on the one in the first part of giving up what he had to Jesus, which allows Jesus to perform this miracle.
Right. So it's like the offertory. We bring the bread and wine.
To go even a step back, further back, Jesus didn't have to be born of a woman to become incarnate. It just like Adam was, boom, you know,
God,
a body.
God chose,
the scripture tells us he chose Mary.
And he also chose to ask Mary for consent.
Exactly. She participated in that.
So Mary's body, Mary's consent, in the same way, like we provide the bread and wine, we bring the bread and wine to Mass. In some communities, like in the East, they actually, parishioners,
each family brings picks a Sunday and brings the bread and wine. Yeah.
Right. So, but even, you know, so we bring them and then the miracle happens because we participated in
making it happen. And so that's part of what the Holy Father is saying. And then when the people break the bread and fish and hand it on, the miracle happens. Like, it doesn't just, like, it's not like, okay, here's five loaves and fishes, he snaps his finger and now there's 45 baskets full. No, as the bread is broken and passed on and each person gets as much as they want, there more and more bread is appearing. In the act of sharing, there is the multiplication. The multiplication doesn't happen before Jesus feeds the people. The multiplication happens as the people are fed, as they're eating.
Which is interesting because there have been other miracles, like there was a miracle that I remember reading about St. Nicholas where there's a famine and he ends up, St. Nicholas takes grain off of a shipment from Rome. And the Roman official says, I'm going to be in trouble because I'm supposed to show up in Rome with this manifest,
so much
grain. And Nicholas says, oh, don't worry, you will.
Right.
So he takes off as much grain as the people need, but the ship still arrives in Rome with as much grain as it's supposed to have.
Right.
There's that multiplication of, or like the widow in Elijah, the story of Elijah.
I was just about to say that.
As she makes the bread every day, the jar doesn't go.
Right. It's a famine. She has enough oil and flour left to make one more loaf of bread for her and her son, and then they will starve. And Eliza shows up and says, make me some food to eat. And rather than say, hey, buddy, I don't have enough to feed my son, never mind you, take Ike, she makes it for him. She's generous with the little she has, just like the boy was generous with the little he had. And just as all the 5,000 plus their wives and children were generous with the little that they were given. And that generosity is rewarded with an unlimited supply of, you know, for her, oil and flour, so that they could survive the famine. God always, you know, everything we give to God is multiplied back to us.
A hundredfold,
a thousandfold, or whatever we need. I think that's really what the Holy Father is saying. So I get that there is a valid criticism of the, you know, there wasn't really a miracle. It was just people sharing what they had. That's dumb. But what the Holy Father was saying is the miracle that Jesus performs, the multiplication happens because people shared with one another. And what in his Angelus message, he was telling us, all of us, to share what we have, to participate in the miracle of God providing for those who need. God's not just going to drop a shipment of grain out of the air on people. That's not how he works. It's going to happen because we are generous, not with just food, but with time and, you know, love and all these other things.
Right. That, which reminds me of a friend of mine who said, you know, she sort of practices the radical abandonment to God's will. And so at one point she's a single mom and she's really struggling. And she gets a bill unexpectedly, and it's just way more money than she's ever going to be have. And so she just says, God, I'm going to trust you. You're going to take care of this for me because I've trusted you with my life. And the next day, the exact amount of the bill shows up unexpectedly from an unexpected source.
Wow.
There's that sort of radical, God finds a way to meet our needs when we trust in him.
Radical trust.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and if
there was a human mechanism. Somebody chose to give her money.
Right,
in some
it
way.
Didn't just show up out of thin air on the table, which God can do, and perhaps has done in cases. But in most cases, it's someone. You know, Father Bob Casey in the Catholic TV Mass today said something along the lines of, "You'll never meet a sad, generous person who's sad in the act of generosity." And you'll never meet someone who's happy as they're being stingy.
That's true.
You know, there is something in us that says to be generous is good and makes me happy. And to be stingy is bad. And I should be unhappy about being stingy. Like, you know, obviously that it's not like you'll never meet someone who's generous, who's never sad. I mean, that's not true. But
their generosity isn't the occasional act for sadness.
Right, but in the act of generosity, you never see someone who in the act of generosity is sad about it. And you will never see someone who, in the act of being stingy, is happy, not truly happy. There's often other emotions in there that involve smiling, but it's usually cruel or mean. But anyway, so that was some of my thoughts on the homily. I mean, on the gospel. But today was also
Grandparents' Day. Oh, my goodness.
The Holy Father declared today for the church World Day of Grandparents and the Elderly.
I love this idea. When I read the announcement for the first time, I just so happy. Like, tomorrow's the feast of St. Anne and St. Joachim, but we celebrated it today because it's Sunday.
Yes. We celebrate the World Day.
The World Day for grandparents. And I just love this. Like, St. Anne and St. Joachim, one of the things that the deacon said at our Mass was, you know, Jesus had grandparents. Now, St. Anne and St. Joachim, the names we have from tradition, not from the Bible.
Right.
But it's a long-standing tradition in the church that Mary's parents had names. And the idea of Jesus having grandparents, like that he had a grandma and a granddad who cared for him, who loved him, who
right.
bounced him on their knees and maybe took turns changing his diaper. Like, you know,
I change this kid's diaper, it's immaculate.
he had a family, and Mary and Joseph didn't just spring up out of nowhere, and Jesus didn't just have mom and dad and himself. He had an extended family that we know.
We don't know anything about Joseph's parents, do we?
We don't, but there's nothing to say that they weren't involved
sure.
in Jesus's life. It's possible. You know, in one speculation I've seen, I think it was Anne Rice's novel, she speculated that the whole clan might have gone to Egypt. It wasn't just Mary and Joseph and Jesus, like the flight to Egypt with just the two of them, the three of them on a donkey.
Uh-huh.
But it could very well have been that Mary and Joseph's families went with them. And it was a sort of a tribe,
right.
a clan, a group of families who went together to Egypt in exile, which I really liked that idea. I know that the book had other problems with it in terms of some of the speculation. But I loved the idea that Jesus came into being not just with a mom and a dad, but with an extended family of cousins and
aunts and uncles. Well, that's what family looked like.
Right.
Well, and when the Bible talks about Jesus's brothers, you know, your cousins and your extended family were essentially like brothers.
Right. Like
brothers and sisters. You all lived in proximity and usually in one extended house.
Right. Like my friend, my former roommate, Neve, she's an only child, but her mom's sister married her dad's brother, and they had like three or four kids. And then she had other cousins, too. And she said she never felt like an only child because she had so many cousins that she was close to growing up, that they were in and out of each other's homes. They were always together. And so in a lot of ways, she wasn't really an only child, even though it was just her and her parents and their nuclear family.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the importance of family. But I really wanted to jump to, like, grandparents. And I really loved what Pope Francis said about the treasures that our elderly people are, the gifts that they have to share, that they have a vocation in old age, not just to be cared for, but they continue to care for and to pass on wisdom, memory, dreams, and they have the ability to pray for us, to continue to do the act of prayer is something that they're not incapable of, you know, no matter how old and frail they are.
You know, in wisdom that comes with age, because even, you know, just merely by having lived a long time, you learn a lot. I mean, you just can't help it. I've learned some things. And but with that experience comes the ability to, it's not necessarily that you have a special insight per se. You've just seen enough where you can start to pass on lessons to younger people in gentle ways, hopefully, of, hey, this, imagine this, the dreams part of Pope Francis is, you know, the gifts of the elderly. Imagine a different way of doing things. Imagine a world that's more just. Imagine a world that's more loving. Imagine in your life being this way. I've made these mistakes in life. And imagine doing that. It's different coming from a grandparent than it is from a parent, and very often.
Right. Sometimes we have those clashes of will with our parents. You know, I want to do things differently than my parents did.
Well, because parents are the disciplinarians. They've been telling you can't do this and you can't do that. Grandparents they don't have that burden.
Right. So we have a different sort of relationship with our grandparents than we do with our parents. It's not that we don't see their flaws, but we aren't necessarily the direct recipients of their mistakes.
Sure.
In some ways.
Yeah. I didn't know my grandparents very well. I mean, my mom's father died when she was 7, so there was no way to know him. Her mom died when I was a baby. My grandfather on my dad's side died when I was 8, so I didn't really know him that well. And my grandmother on my dad's side died when I was maybe senior in high school. And she only spoke Italian. So I didn't know them very well, but I did know my mom's uncle, who essentially raised her, Uncle Albert, much better. And I remember that one time when I was in maybe middle school, they sent me to stay with him for a week. And just that, I don't know, spending time with him and learning. I loved spending time with my parents' friends who were older and learning from them and hearing their stories. I loved hearing stories. I love Father Murphy's stories, you know, who was, a friend and a mentor in many ways.
And kind of a grandfather figure.
Kind of a grandfather figure. And I loved hearing the stories of the way things were and the way things that they've learned and the experiences that they've had. And those things have shaped me.
Actually, come to think of it, like, I didn't really know either of my grandfathers. They both died when I was very little. I knew both of my grandmas. My dad's mom came to visit us a few times, and we went to visit her a few times. They lived in Illinois, so it wasn't close.
Yeah.
And my mom's mom lived in Arizona. We went and visited her a few times, and she came and visited us sometimes. But there was a year when she moved to Austin temporarily, and I'm sure that there was much more of a story that I, being a child, didn't hear. Thinking about it now, it's kind of odd, but she got an apartment that was right next to the parish school where I went to school. Like, her apartment complex backed onto the athletic field. And so a couple days a week after school, I would go hang out at my grandma's apartment. It was just me, because the other kids were too little to do that. And so it was just me and grandma. And there was like one summer when I was sent off to stay with grandma in Arizona for a couple of weeks. And it was really nice to have spent time mm-hmm. with her and to really get to know her.
I remember I was little. I actually, now that I think about it, I spent a week over my Auntie Jenny's, where my nana, my dad's mom, lived with Auntie Jenny. And I spent a week in a summer, Evie and I, there in their Cambridge second floor walk up, and with the garden, the most amazing garden you've ever seen, an urban garden that could have fed a village of 5,000. I mean, it really was the multiplication of food my uncle had grown there. But I remember, like, there's some aspects of that are so meaningful, that time with them. Even when my grandmother couldn't, you know, communicate clearly in English, there was still something communicated in that. I still knew she loved me. I mean, she certainly fed me some awesome food. Let me tell you, I would give to spend it a week with my grandmother now. And I really want that. Like, when our kids spend time to stay with my dad and his stories, especially. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Bella and Sophie and even Ben are old enough to, and I think Anthony too, to absorb some of those stories when they can sit still and listen. I really want them to sit with him.
Oh gosh, I love your dad's stories. I mean, he talks about, like, he was a newspaper boy and he was selling papers when World War II broke out.
Yes.
Like, he remembers selling the newspaper with the headlines.
Extra war breaks out in,
like, that's,
he was that kid.
That's crazy. That's like dad. Yeah. Like, remembers the beginning of World War II. Well,
on the opposite street corner from Leonard Nimoy, who was also a newspaper boy in his neighborhood. And they were on opposite street corners. Who would have thunk? I've actually tried to record some of my dad's stories. I've started doing that now. But I want them to do that now before it's too late. My dad's not young. My dad's going to be 90 soon. You know, it's...
Right.
They need to take it. He's going to be 89 this year. They need to experience that for themselves, and my mom and your parents. One of the things I really am sad about is that the past year, because of the pandemic, your parents haven't been able to come and visit. And that's important that they are able to spend time with your parents.
Right.
Thank God for FaceTime that they've been able to do that at least.
Yeah, at least they've been able to like say hi and wave and like even have some conversations with my parents.
But there's certainly that passing on of the dreams, the memory, the your experiences, the life, family, the idea of this is your history. That's one of the things I'm most grateful for from my parents and grandparents and older people in our lives is the passing on of our history and a sense of who I am in time. That is so important.
Yeah. I also, when thinking about prayer, like I think about like the examples that our parents set for our kids, like in terms of, you know, your dad goes up to the church every day and he mm-hmm. prays his rosary every day and he's got his list of everybody he prays for. And I think it's awesome for the kids to see that, you know, the life of faith that our parents all have. You know, they really all walk really closely with God and they are able to share that experience and wisdom too with them
mm-hmm.
and to pray for our kids.
Well, and when your dad comes to visit, you know, every day he's got his breviary and he sits and prays the divine office every day with them. You know, he hasn't actually done it with them yet. Hopefully maybe next time when he comes to visit, he can pray with them. And we've been doing night prayer. Maybe he can do night prayer with us. But, you know, it's so awesome to see our parents sharing that aspect of themselves with our kids. And, you know, God willing, we can do that someday ourselves.
Right.
Know? Anyway, so I'm just annoyed that I was so old when we met and got married. God give me the many years to live so I can pass these things on to my grandchildren someday.
I mean, this is why the blessing is may you see your children's children.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there is a blessing in grandparents. There is a huge blessing that comes from the elderly, not just, you know, like all the elderly in our lives, not just our family. There are plenty of older folks who have been in my life who've been important. Like Father Murphy was so important to me.
Right.
I still miss him. And, you know, other folks who have been mentors and passed on wisdom, like my mom's friends, Ursula and Carolee, who mm-hmm. lived on the farm in Maine, and Mrs. Larner, Carolee's mom. There's these very influential people in our lives who have, you know, stuck with us. Gosh, even Mama Duck there was this old lady who lived down the street from the farm in Maine who raised ducks, and everyone called her Mama Duck. I have no idea what her real name was, but she was quite the main character, let me tell you. And she had some of the funniest stories. But
like the old guy, the kid's Grandpa Chicken.
Grandpa Chicken. He's this old guy who helps out with the scout troop.
But I love the fact that the scout troop has that sort of memory. Like, I remember when I was at UD in college, there was an older retired priest, Father Kane. He was one of the Dominicans,
mm-hmm.
and he was retired. He had been a brilliant professor. But by the time I was there, he was retired and he wasn't teaching anymore. And he wandered around campus and he would, you know, stop students on their way to classes and engage in conversations with them. And he would sing songs. sometimes he had he would play the comb kazoo and he would sing Waltzing Matilda. He had like a little frog puppet that he would sometimes talk with. He was just this wonderful.
Every Catholic university should have one of those, because we had one.
And then there were some of the older Cistercians too. Like some of the pre-Cistercian monks had escaped from Hungary, like
from the communists,
like in these dramatic, like helping smuggle people out of communist Europe and across the borders and escaping themselves. I mean, they had some great stories, and I just love that there's this sort of memory of reaching back in time, you know?
Yeah. Someday I'm going to need to tell some Father Gus stories from Steubenville. Can't remember Father Gus's last name, but he was one of the old monks from Steubenville, and he was the funniest guy ever. Like, he was, I mean, he was just this old, this little old monk, bald, kind of chubby, and he'd kind of, especially at the beginning of the semester, he'd kind of hobble along the walkways. Like, it's like, I remember one time he was hobbling along the walkway, in all bundled up in his black friar's robe, his monk's robe, and shuffling along in the snow is all around. And then he comes up to this group of kids and he just pushes one of the boys into the snow and runs off. He was known as a prankster. He was so funny. It was great. But he also has great homilies. Best homily I've ever heard is also the shortest. He said, negative humor belongs in the pits of hell. Keep it there. And then walked back to his seat. And that was the end of the homily.
Wow.
Father Gus was awesome.
Succinct.
Yeah. There was the time he pranked one of the other friars by giving him a gift of onions that he snuck into his closet and then forgot about it. Like, he was pranking him with this gift and he was going to pull it out at some point and totally forgot that he'd put it in this other monk friar's closet. And then they started to stink.
Oh,
what is the smell in the monastery?
Father, oh my Gus. Gosh.
Oh, so, there's lots of Father Gus stories, but anyway, we're getting far afield and we're going long. So yep. We need to wrap it up.
I just wanted to say one last thing. In Mother Sophia's reflections on Mount St. Mary, she reflects on the gift of the older sisters in their community. And she ended with a quote, which I just absolutely love, from the Psalms. Still full of sap, still green. One of the older sisters, she says, uses it to describe herself. And I love that idea that there's still some life in me.
There's still life. Yeah.
Planted in the house of the Lord, they will flourish in the courts of our God, still bearing fruit when they are old, still full of sap, still green, to proclaim that the Lord is good to him.
In him.
In him, my rock, there is no wrong.
Psalm 92.
I just love that. This is what the elderly have to give to us, to proclaim that the Lord is good. There's no wrong.
Just because you're old doesn't mean you're dead. You still have life and you still have much to give. You have fruit to bear. And it's something for all of us to remember, the old and the young alike, that the elderly among us, still full of life, still green, you know, still alive, there's still life in them. Still full of sap. That's so true for some of us old folks. We're still full of sap. Anyway, that's very good. Yes. Happy Grandparents and Elderly Day.
Yes. And thank you to all of our.
Thank you. Yeah.
All of our elders who give us so much.
Yep. All right. Speaking of thanking people, I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Mita D., Fabian K., Joshua D., Jordan H., and Carmen M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So we'd love to get your feedback on anything we talked about today. You can do that by commenting at sqpn.com/bet. That's BETTS. The SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Send an email to bets@sqpn.com. You can even do like Michael did and go to the SQPN YouTube channel and leave a comment there. And I'll put links from our discussion in our show notes on sqpn.com. Make sure to follow Raising the Bets, if you haven't done so yet, in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the aforementioned YouTube channel. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.